Good morning. We'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session from May City Council for Thursday, November 1st, 2012. The first item, we'd like to excuse Councilmember Kavanaugh, who's out of town and won't be joining us today. We'd like to begin today's meeting with a review of next Monday's regular council meeting. Okay, is everyone set? Page 2, items 3A through 3D. Items 3E through 5B. Councilmember Higgins? Oh, Councilmember Richens. Go.
Maybe we should have a quick reminder, primer about off-track betting.
Okay, item
this
4A.
I think this is the first license that we've seen, unless I forgot. So. Let's just have a quick primer about the action we took about a year ago and what this is.
Okay. Mr. Guidens.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. So just paraphrasing from the presentation that we did in June, off-track betting has been around in Arizona for about 16 years. There are six cities that have off-track betting located in their jurisdictions. There's 62 locations in the state, 42 are in the Metro Phoenix area. This is prompted by the changes that occurred in the zoning code in July of 2011, and it became a permitted use in Mesa in September of last year. Off-track betting is regulated by the Arizona Gaming Commission. The council, the way we set the ordinance up, the options that we had in front of us and the one we chose was that council would license the off-track betting parlors. They do need to be located within a restaurant. They can't be a standalone, so they have to be located with a partner. And the council has the authority to approve or deny an off-track betting license. If the council approves it, it moves on to the Gaming Commission, and if the council denies it, then it stops here. And one of the benefits of licensing was that we, when it comes to the renewals, to suspensions, revoking a license that, because we did license it, that does fall within the purview of the council. So we as a city do have a considerable latitude on whether or not we want this use to continue and whether or not we want an off-track betting facility to continue in our community.
The name of the restaurant this is going in is?
RTO Sullivan's.
RTO
Sullivan's. Out at Superstition Springs.
Thanks.
Okay, Councilmember Higgins.
And Mayor, I asked for this to be pulled off consent.
Okay, so great. Item 4A will be removed from consent. Vice Mayor?
Just maybe Pete is a better one to ask, but how have these folks been as a resident of our fine city?
RTO Sullivan's?
Yeah.
Or
crime issues, underage drinking, anything like that?
No, we do have a schedule in the application and the council report. In 2012, they've had 16 calls for service at RTO Sullivan's, and seven of those have been calls with reports written.
Okay, but compared to others of similar uses, I would expect them to receive some level of service. Does that seem out of the norm?
Council member, it's really out of my realm to answer
that
question, but we can get that
from PD there.
We can get that for Monday.
All right, we'll just do that.
I think the better issue is how many Quinellas do we expect to hit after this is a now, this is a good crowd. Yeah, most of them don't know what a Quinella. Okay, go ahead.
That's Kiwa.
An ancient queen Kiwa. From Egypt. Queen Quinella. Okay.
Weird.
Any other questions? Okay, item 4A will be removed from the consent agenda then. Anything else, 3E through 5B? Items 6A through 6C? 6D through 6F? Councilmember Higgins.
Item 6D, I was just wondering, we had talked about hours that helicopters have been flying, and I was anticipating a report next time we'd like looked at helicopters, like how much time are they in the air, which ones are flying where, et cetera. And also, like, this is parts, right? But we have, I'm sure, scheduled maintenance, so we know per hour how much it's going to cost for each helicopter on a yearly, just like oil changes. So this is extra over and above, right? So, you know, just wanted way more information.
Okay. Council Member, Mr. Mayor, the scheduled maintenance costs are quantified by hours on the engine. Each engine at 1770 hours has to have what we would consider a minor overhaul. That cost can range anywhere between $50,000 to $100,000. At approximately 7,500 hours, the engines go through a major overhaul, and that can run upwards of $200,000 to $250,000, at times less. There's turbine wheels in the helicopter, each one of those that needs to be repaired. The cost becomes a bit more exorbitant as each is repaired. These aren't our regulations, they're FAA regulations that we have to adhere to. One of the difficulties is not being able to predict other costs or mechanical issues or repairs that need to take place beyond the scope of those that we are relegated to or mandated to. As the cycles go, for instance, if you look back in the previous 3 years, you'll see periods of time where the expenditures were not near the overall request of cost by the council for council approval. But during those years, we didn't hit a cycle of 7,500 hours. We may have only had one minor overhaul. In fact, I think in the instance of 2009, 2010, we might not even have had a minor overhaul. Those might have been just regular repairs on a helicopter. It might have been a fuel pump. But the costs, as compared to, say, with one of our automobiles, are exorbitant on these Rolls-Royce engines.
So do you have it in a report form that you just show how many hours in the last, well, average, or heck, for the last 3 years? You reference it, so is it written down so we can just see how many hours stuff's in the air?
We can. The difficulty is, I think with this year, we anticipated possibly having a new helicopter in the fleet. We did not do that, so now we have to put more hours on the engines. Once we put more hours on the engines that we have, that's where we can't predict it. As we put more hours on the engines that we have, the more the costs go up. Sure. With the overhauls.
But we know how many hours each helicopter has been in the air for last year. That's tracked.
For the last year, yes, ma'am.
And then, you know, and you just anticipate probably the same for next year if you're flying the same three helicopters-ish, I'm guessing.
I wouldn't want to answer that today and tell you that I could get within, I wouldn't even want to tell you I could get within 100 hours to 500 hours of guessing it. I wouldn't be accurate stating that.
But we can get something from the last 3 years to see how many hours.
Average, yes.
Average. The helicopters have been flying.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. I'd love to see that.
Okay, you bet.
Great, thanks.
Councilman Fender?
You know, as we review these agendas, I saw this cost on there, but I think we just had a recent example in the last week or so of what I would call an extraordinary savings of taxpayer dollars by utilizing the helicopter, as we all sit in council sometimes in these settlements. The exact way this thing should have been used and probably saved millions of dollars in litigation. Do you mind taking just a second to describe that?
Sure. last Friday morning, in the wee early hours, one of our canine officers observed a pickup truck that he initially thought the driver was impaired. He radioed it in, said he was going to attempt to stop the vehicle. As he attempted to do so, the vehicle hit the truck in front of him and then fled. The officer justly assumed that they may have been together. As the vehicle took off at a high rate of speed, the officer shut down, did not go in pursuit, just announced the vehicle was fleeing, traffic offenses only, last known direction of travel entering US 60. At that point, the air unit was timely, was overhead, was able to see the vehicle. During the time the air unit followed the vehicle, we couldn't tell that there were any other bodies other than the driver in the vehicle. I have to give credit both to the chief and to one of our lieutenants that was on scene. A couple of weeks previous to that, we had noticed an escalation in our vehicle wrecks and our pursuit intervention techniques, where we take vehicles off. And with the collisions, the chief really wanted to be steadfast that we're not going to pursue vehicles unless it really is a detriment to the community or would cause harm to the community. The lieutenant knew that that was the mandate and the order that had gone out probably 3 weeks before, and none of our officers engaged. The only thing our lieutenant did was shut down intersections, because as this truck started to flee from the Department of Public Safety, which did engage, it was causing a safety risk to the rest of the community. So he stopped intersections back and forth. The air unit stayed overhead, did an outstanding job of calling this thing that lasted approximately 29 minutes. At one point, the vehicle tried to turn the corner at Country Club and Baseline in a southwesterly turn, and as he did so, he lost control of the vehicle, hit a power pole where he died, and quickly we observed that there were 19 people in the pickup truck. They're in the bed, around it. I think that having the air unit overhead gives us the ability to back off of a vehicle as much as we possibly can, hopefully and surreptitiously to the driver, continue to follow the vehicle so we can apprehend the offender without escalating the situation or putting any of our citizens in harm's way. It also gave us the ability for the air unit to say, this is where he's headed, this is where we think he's going to go, this is how far we think he's going to go at this speed, and we can start shutting down intersections so we didn't have cross traffic. And for certain, by doing that evening, we saved at least one or two people who were about to drive into the path of this guy who was going 90 miles an hour on Baseline, not because Mesa PD was pushing him, and even by that point DPS had backed off, but our air unit was able to stay overhead and immediately announce it and call it. So yeah, they're invaluable in their use and the safety for the community.
Thanks, Chief.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Where are we?
6G through 6I. Vice Mayor?
On 6H, I believe it's a security guard services extended contract. I just wanted to, I'm looking at the period of time for the increase being about 2 months, the prior period 4 months, and it's the same amount of money. It's $200,000. So, in essence, it's twice as expensive for November and December. I'm just curious as to why the increase is the same amount as the prior term contract.
Mayor, council member, I believe it was just a math error when we were doing the initial extension of the contract from July 1st through October 31st. I think we did the four-month term, but only three months of money. And that also played in. I think the error was caused by the fact that we pay in arrears on that. We pay for the month prior. So I think we just messed up, and it's my responsibility, my error. We just messed up on the dollar amount that requested for the July through the October extension.
And how much were they requesting for that?
It should have been $200,000 for a three-month period, not $200,000 for a four-month period. So now because we're going the full 6 months, it'll be 200 and 200 for the 400,000.
Okay, so it's 2 3-month periods, not a four and a
yes.
two.
Okay, yes.
So it's the same amount either
right.
way. Do we need to change that on this document?
This is correct. It was a math error when we put it together initially. So we're now adding money so that we can pay the September bill as well as the October bill as well as the November and December.
So what you're saying is that this is the correction.
This is the correction, yes.
Okay. And then I'm looking at an old document.
No, you're looking at the correct document, but let's see, how can I explain this? We did 4 months of extensions in June. So we did July, August, September, and October, but we only gave ourselves 3 months of money.
Okay.
So it was just a math error in June.
It still looks wrong.
Okay.
It looks odd.
Yeah.
All right.
But I get it. So, all right.
Okay. Item 6J and 6K. Councilmember, you got another thing?
No, item 6J.
6J.
I just wondered, when we approve this process of design, are we going to have a chance to come back with costs at that time and decide what we're doing? How is this working?
Right now we're in design, okay. And we're we're at about 90% completion on the design. This contract hires the contractor to get them on board to help us with value engineering, cost estimating, schedule control, materials ordering, and kind of get the project moving a little faster, so it's the construction manager at risk for okay. the project. Once we have some initial cost estimates, the first thing we need is a cost model from the contractor. And when we have that, we'll have the cost. There are some budget challenges. Construction prices are going up. I need a contractor at the table to help us with those costs and figure out everything that we can get within our budget. And then they will present a guaranteed maximum price, which we bring to council and review with council as a contract.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Items 6L through 7B. 7C through 8B. 8C through 11A.
Mayor.
Yeah, Mr. Brady.
We're going to pull 8C.
8C.
Yeah.
Okay. 8C has been removed from the agenda.
More work going on that, or?
Need to make some, there's some timing issues we need to tweak.
Okay. And item 12A and 12B. Okay. Next item is to hear a presentation, discuss, provide direction on the Gilbert Road Light Rail Extension. Ms. Sorrell.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. About a year and a half ago, we started some work on looking at extending light rail further east to Gilbert Road. Since that time, we've done a feasibility study, and we're in the middle of an environmental assessment right now. So what we wanted to do this morning is kind of share with you where we are, where we're at with the study. This is strictly just an informational piece to kind of tell you where we're at, where we're going in the next steps, and then we'll be meeting with you individually in the next month and be back in a month for with more information. So I have with me Ben Limmer, who's the planning manager for Metro, and Wolf Grote, the director of planning. Is that what your title is now? planning for the agency as well, and they'll give the presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Jody. Good morning, Mayor and members of City Council. I'm here today to provide you an update on the Gilbert Road Light Rail project. As many of you know, the Central Mesa locally preferred alternative recommendation from 2009 did include the 2-mile Gilbert Road Light Rail extension. And then after that point, last year, the City of Mesa requested that Valley Metro do a study to evaluate this 2-mile light rail project out to Gilbert Road. What we did was we looked at various alternatives, future ridership patterns, and so forth. And we completed this study earlier this summer. And then in July, we started the environmental document, which is required for any transit project using federal funds. The study area for the for our study was between University Drive on the north, Broadway on the south, Mesa Drive on the west, which is where the 3-mile Central Mesa project ends, of course, and then Gilbert Road on the east. Our planning study shown here looked at these variety of factors. What it did is it allowed the city and Valley Metro to further define the project scope, the station locations, ridership patterns, capital and operating costs, major constructability constraints, connecting transit supportive land use, as well as economic opportunities. Last but not least, it did allow us to start talking with the stakeholders along the 2 mile study area. As I mentioned earlier, we completed the planning study earlier this summer, started the environmental assessment, which will be evaluating a number of factors to identify any potential impacts to the environment. Listed on this slide are just a few of the major factors being evaluated. The development of this EA typically takes about 15 months start to finish, so we do anticipate that we will be completed late next summer. Environmental clearance is really key because it does allow the project team to begin utility relocation activities as well as right-of-way acquisition. In the planning study, we started with 13 options, and throughout that 15-month study, we did narrow it down to 3 alternatives to be carried forward, one of which was a 4-lane alternative, which basically keeps the existing number of traffic lanes that are between Mesa Drive and Gilbert Road today. And then we also looked at a 2-lane option, which reduces the vehicle capacity by 1 lane. And then we also did take a look at roundabouts, 5 potential roundabouts between Mesa Drive and Gilbert, one at Horn, one at Miller Street, one at Lazona, one at Harris, and one at South Williams. The 4-lane option does include a center running light rail with 2 through lanes of vehicle traffic on each side. It does keep the bike lane, but it does remove all 200 plus on-street parking spaces. There's some right-of-way required with this option, in particular at the station locations, as well as the traffic intersections. The 2-lane option includes a center running light rail and then 1 through lane of vehicle traffic on each side of the light rail. It does keep the bike lane, and it does still eliminate about half or 100 of the on-street parking spaces. It does require less right-of-way, and then the cross-section for the roundabouts, whether it's on the 2-lane or the 4-lane option, does have the same, basically the same right-of-way impacts. As I mentioned earlier, there are 5 roundabouts being analyzed. The reason for the roundabout option is it could potentially mitigate any traffic impacts from the installation of a center running light rail by improving access to the neighborhoods and businesses next to the alignment. The roundabouts would include pedestrian signals on Main Street as well as traffic signals to control the vehicle traffic when the light rail is active. The roundabout also includes gates for safety between the light rail and the vehicle traffic. That's actually a federal standard. There is an example of a roundabout being used with light rail in Salt Lake City. I know many of you have seen this video. I had a few technical glitches this morning. I wanted to bring it and show it one more time for those of you who have not seen it, but I did have a few glitches, so my utmost apologies.
Vice Mayor?
How people in Arizona, people in the United States, aren't really used to roundabouts. They still cuss them out when they go off the freeways and they get to them. They work very well as a traffic calming measure, but given that level of confusion, how has the experience in Utah been with not only a roundabout, but also traffic interacting with light rail?
from the conversations that we've had, you know, roundabouts, you know, there's often a lot of skepticism around them, but over time the community has, you know, kind of learned how to use it and has been pretty supportive of its
You know anything about the number of accidents? Is it causing a larger number of accidents than a traditional signaled intersection, or fewer accidents? No idea. Maybe that's something.
But Mayor and Council, I think one of the things, and we can maybe Wolf could help me speak to this. When we get talked about the roundabouts and looked at, so what purpose they serve, what, how they benefit the overall project. One of the things that's interesting, and one of the concerns we have, especially along the light rail line, as we look towards it as being a transportation mode, which is important to move people, but we also look at it as an opportunity for economic development, a way to kind of revitalize an area. The challenge, however, though, as soon as we put a track and a train in the middle of the street, we eliminate kind of the opportunity for the left turn, opportunities to get to businesses on either side. So today, when we provide for kind of a left turn, we have to go to a left turn, what do we call them, pocket?
Pocket.
Pockets. So it requires a significant amount of waiting to go through lights to get that left turn to get around a train. So that's one, the advantage of one of the of a roundabout. One advantage would be is that it could potentially provide a kind of a continuous smooth opportunity to allow vehicles that are on the opposite side from a business they want to get to on the other side of the track to go through a roundabout continuously to get there.
Right.
Now, some of the other things we were talking about, the advantages and disadvantages of the roundabout, having to be the continue that, well, how it does with traffic getting to the intersections and things like that. If maybe we could speak to the
how do you stop the traffic so that the train can get through?
Two ways. Yeah, it's easy.
What'll happen with that is the gates will come down. So there's flashing lights with a gate. As the train's coming, they'll come down. No traffic will be able to pass through the circle until the train clears. So, at peak, we have a 12-minute.
Dan, I don't. The gates don't keep cars from going into the circle. It keeps them from crossing the portion of the track on the circle.
Right, but once they're in the circle, if they are passing through, they wouldn't be able to continue through. So,
yeah, the gates are parallel to the tracks.
You couldn't cross the track.
They can't cross it. They can. Unless there's a light there that stops them from entering the circle, they can still turn right. They can still go straight through. They can't
through traffic. Correct.
They can't go. They can't turn left.
Correct.
Across the tracks.
Correct.
Okay.
But the benefits to the roundabout are, as Mr. Brady said, even though traffic's going slower, they're constantly moving. So you have fewer delays there. And when you talk about crashes, roundabouts experience fewer crashes than a typical intersection. And then when you do have them, they're less severe because of the lower speeds.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you don't have any T-bones either because they're at an angle.
Correct.
Question?
Yeah, Councilman.
And does the roundabout then help the train go faster because it's not stopping at lights big time?
Yeah.
It helps their time, yes. They're gonna have a set speed limit. The speed limit will be whatever the speed limit is on the street. So fewer stops, yes.
That's good. Would basically result in five fewer traffic signals.
And if we had the traffic signals, again, like Mr. Brady said, we have the fully protected left turn arrow. So you pull up, if you have to wait for your green arrow to make that turn, whether it's a U-turn or a left turn, the roundabouts allow you to facilitate that turn better and fewer delays.
Of course, now the trade-off is doing a roundabout takes more space.
More right away.
So we want to be, and we kind of were evaluating this the other day, kind of looking at the potential opportunities for roundabouts and also trying to kind of figure out where we could mitigate against the, you know, the greatest impact to businesses and
which isn't a problem if you're at like La Zona and Main Street where there's nothing but parking lots and
right.
All you do is take a parking lots,
right.
But then all of a sudden you have other intersections
where
there's buildings on the corner.
So we'll continue doing that assessment and bring that to the community and bring it to the council as we go through there. But the opportunity to put a roundabout in, I think Metro supports the idea, and we think there may be an opportunity to.
Yeah, it's hard to explain unless you've really seen how it works, and it's really cool in Salt Lake how it does work. It's very seamless, and you have a constant flow of traffic, unlike here where I think one of the frustrating things for me with light rail is to go sit at a light, and I can't see a light rail for a mile in either direction, and you're sitting there at a red light, and you just feel like an idiot. because you're going, okay, why am I stopped? You know, with a roundabout, that never happens, because the only time that the traffic is impeded is actually when there is a train there and the arms go down for the gates, and it keeps you from going across. And otherwise, and even then, it doesn't totally impede, because you can still turn right, you can go straight through, you can do all sorts of stuff.
And I feel it may not because of the light.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is true. Maybe the light is not the cause of my feelings. Yes. I got you. Thank you, Vice Mayor.
Could we just get the numbers from Salt Lake, though?
Since yeah, certainly.
I'm sure that we'll be able to put it together.
Councilman Finter.
Well, I was just going to say, I lived in London, England for a while, and roundabouts are just an everyday thing there. They work wonderfully. You know, there's a mindset for us here in the United States and out west to think differently, okay. But very safe, very functional, and have been done for decades and decades. So I think it's a great idea.
I propose, though, that I lived in South America, they call them estrellas. So you don't want to change that. Okay, forget it.
All right. Thank you. We are looking at a variety of factors to consider as part of our environmental document. These include right-of-way, property conflicts, building conflicts, average traffic volume, consistency with local plans, and then, of course, the estimated capital costs. The potential right-of-way for the four-lane option, our preliminary estimate is about 90,000 total square feet to maintain the existing roadway and accommodate the stations. The two-lane option requires about 25,000 square feet, mostly at Gilbert Road, to maintain the left turn lane in and out of the proposed park and ride. And then the roundabout option will need a little bit more, 32,000 square feet, to account for the roundabouts, as Mr. Brady mentioned. These numbers could change as we get further along with the project. Also, these numbers do not include any space needed for the end-of-line park and ride at Gilbert Row, which I will talk about a little bit more in just a moment.
If I'm understanding this correctly, you may have said this, the four-lane option, the taking right-of-way needs is the same with or without the roundabouts. Am I reading that correctly?
Okay. Yes.
So 90,000 square feet includes roundabouts.
Yes.
All right. Gotcha.
Yes. And then the potential property conflicts, the four-lane option would require about 59 parcels to accommodate the right-of-way. These are mainly at the traffic signals and the station locations. The two-lane option requires right-of-way on 11 parcels at Gilbert Road, and then the roundabout option requires 26 parcels at Gilbert Road for the left turns in and out of the park ride as well. The potential building conflicts, four-lane option has the potential to hit four buildings, primarily to accommodate the light rail stations and to maintain the lane configurations. And then there could be potential options to reduce these number of building conflicts. We are working with the city on trying to massage some of the station locations to bring that four lower.
Just Mayor and Council, there's some buildings at some major intersections that are very close to the road. For example, Stapley Main. And yet, I don't know how many feet east of there, there's lots of parking. So we're trying to work, and Metro's being very good about letting us consider some options. So, you know, our goal is here, we want business to thrive and survive light rail and not use and light rail be a impact. And
what you're saying, if you move the station one way or another, most 50 to two, I don't know how many feet it would
right.
be, you eliminate the property conflicts, and what you have to look at is that by moving the station, do you create a problem with interaction in the stadium, with the station?
Like with the station and the bus route. So, you know, how far can we go back and still maintain that yet?
Right.
Maybe avoid impacting buildings. But I think we're going to be able to find some compromises there.
Thank you. The traffic volumes, this is an average of 24-hour traffic volumes for each of the options between Mesa and Lindsay Road. The two-lane option will have an average volume of about, or the four-lane option will have an average volume of about 28,000 vehicles per day, and then both of the two-lane options are roughly 20,000 vehicles.
Let me ask you this. I mean, yes. If I just do those numbers, I'm looking at it, and it's too early in the morning to actually do the percentages, but you're not looking at a whole lot fewer cars, but you're trying to squeeze them through a lot smaller space.
Are we comfortable with these numbers? Because that, to me, that's the biggest issue, one of the larger issues about the four to two lane is what impact does it have on the number of vehicles and the speed of the vehicles going up.
Yeah, because I think one thing here is not just the throughput, but the congestion.
Mayor, these are an average over 3 miles. Even it includes a mile outside of the project area. So they will range from low 20s to mid 30s.
Well, I'm not concerned about the numbers of cars. What I'm saying is what we haven't addressed here is the congestion factor. Because let's just say these numbers are about right. What you're saying is that you're taking four lanes, reducing it by half, but the potential traffic is not reduced by half. So what that means is that you're putting a higher proportion of the traffic through a smaller space.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Usually when that happens, I'm not a traffic engineer, but if I'm trying to put more cars through fewer lanes, I sort of think there's going to be an increase in congestion.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is that consistent with what you're thinking? I mean, I've seen Main Street on this very stretch when, golly, seems like for a year we had restricted down to one lane while we were putting in some
utilities. Yeah.
Some utilities. And, one lane on Main Street wasn't real pretty. I think Stapley, it was typical to be backed up clear, quarter mile or more, and took you three or four lights to get through. Is that about right?
That's right.
Okay. So
what we're seeing so far in the model, Stapley is kind of a problem area. We're working with Metro's traffic engineering consultant over the next two or three weeks just to refine the numbers and kind of expected level of service, but Stapley.
But would you agree with the general premise based on what you've seen that if you go from four lanes to two lanes, there will be,
yes, sir,
significant congestion issues?
There'll be more.
So that's part of the trade-off. This isn't just a numbers game.
Yeah.
What we're looking at, because I'm assuming, like even during construction, you didn't see what you might normally see on Main Street, especially when you have Broadway and University that are both only a half mile away, and so you'd think that there would be a redirection of a lot of that through traffic, but I don't think that's necessarily the case because of all the activity that's going on along Main Street.
Question.
So, okay. Councilman Higgins.
Yeah, thanks. Are we those pictures look like when you say four to two, we're talking two through lanes on either side.
Right.
Or three lanes plus what? Because no. I don't see anything that shows four traffic lanes in each direction.
No, not in each
four
direction.
Four total.
Four total.
There's four today.
Two on each side versus one on each side.
But. Oh, so the very, I'm trying, I guess I don't even see the.
On the two lane, I think what you're seeing is that there's a, it calls for on-street parking on part of the way.
But there's still four lanes going total, two in each direction.
I think we're showing two different options. Today we have two lanes each direction. Mm-hmm. We're showing an option with light rail that will have maintained two lanes in each direction. The alternate is one lane each direction.
You're showing the left turn lanes. I think that's what's throwing. One of those is just a left turn lane. It's not a through. It only becomes. It becomes four lanes.
If you look at slide eight, you want to move back to slide eight.
Got
there
it.
You go. See it in the upper left-hand corner.
Yeah,
it's hard to read, but that's one through traffic, one park traffic, and a bike lane.
Got it.
Then if you look over to the right, that is the intersections, which shows a left turn lane.
Got it. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
And Mayor, just so we're clear, the constraint we're going to see is at the signalized intersections. The mid-block congestion we don't anticipate to be real significant, but that's where our constraint is because you can only allocate a certain amount of green time for each of those.
And that's, in the construction period, that's where the restrictions came, is trying to get through Stapley.
Yeah.
Okay.
Question, is it, and there's a right-hand turn lane still, like a D-cell lane? Bus pull out? No, at the intersections, big intersections?
I don't think we're going to be having any right turn lanes.
So it's just on the two-lane option, it's one lane in each direction, no pull out on the to make a right-hand turn on the big intersections.
I believe
because the roundabouts are taken care of. But
right. Well, you could have that option, but what we're saying is, for example, if you go to Stapley and Main, if you want to do a right turn lane, you're going to have to remove all those buildings.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
That's the trade-off you'd have.
And
right turn versus the building. And that would affect, I think, pretty much all four buildings.
At least three.
At least three of them.
Yeah.
Maybe the one on the southeast corner is set back enough, but you're going to take away most of the...
yeah, that auto place. Or
whatever it is now. But certainly the Denny's, the bank, and the dental are really close to the...
And then, Mayor and Council, the other thing we're looking at, too, and Councilman Richens has kind of asked challenges to look at this, is also how do we really introduce, you know, shade and landscaping in this corridor also. So those are all elements that we've got to challenge ourselves as we look at this corridor. So that's something we want to
do that just because Councilman Richens asked.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
That's a pretty heavily weighted vote there. Cause,
no.
we'll take it. We'll go with it.
Doesn't mean we're going
we'll give in to him this one time. I mean, for heaven's sakes.
Well, he kicks and screams.
I know. We're afraid not to.
It's embarrassing.
All right.
So at the end of this, I think what we're saying is that if we could summarize this four-lane versus two-lane, the two-lane requires less property taking because you don't have to widen the street. But it also creates more congestion. The four-lane... mitigates the congestion, especially through the intersections, but requires more property. And we haven't yet figured out exactly what that is because we're dealing with station locations and all that kind of things. Is that an accurate?
That's accurate.
And on the two-lane, you maintain on-street parking for at least part of the route. And on the four-lane, you eliminate our on-street parking for basically the entire route.
Yes.
Okay. That's a good summary?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Just one point on the traffic. We are looking at traffic that would be diverted to University or Broadway as well, and we're looking at those.
Yeah, I think we need to be concerned about that, though, because on the other hand, remember that Main Street isn't a totally throughput
right.
street. You got a lot of businesses and a lot of things along Main Street, and I know from a traffic standpoint, it sounds nice to say let's divert. We don't want to divert traffic away from those businesses because that would you know, we'd need trees to hide all the empty buildings along there, and we want to be real careful that we don't sacrifice business success for traffic success.
It's just Mayor, that's correct. It's just a balance, though. As there's more congestion, people will look for alternative
right.
routes. So we got to find the balance there.
Okay.
All right. Great. Thank you. We're also doing a park and ride analysis. We have a park and ride model, of course. Transportation planners love their models. It really does a good job of estimating overall demand for the park and ride in Mesa. So we ran this, and this map up here shows the green color represents the travel market for the park and ride at Sycamore. Which is there today. The yellow color represents the expanded coverage area with the park and ride at Gilbert Road. I should say the yellow and the orange. The projected drive access to all three Mesa park and rides, the one at Sycamore, the one at Mesa Drive, and the one at Gilbert Road, is about 2,000 to 3,000 person trips per day or vehicles. This results in a park and ride space demand of about 1,500 spaces for all three lots. Specifically with the Gilbert Road park and ride, that park and ride has a demand of about 500 to 700 spaces. The optimal solution, of course, is to maintain all three park rides, including the end of the line site at Gilbert Road. And actually, when we come back next month, we will bring you not only the traffic work that we completed with the city, but we will also bring forward the specific analysis of the park ride at Gilbert.
Okay, man, Vice Mayor has a question.
Just out of curiosity, how many spots do we have now, and then how many spots are planned for the two additional park and ride sites? Do we know that yet, yeah. or is that going to yeah. be part of that study?
Well, it will be part of that study. Currently at Sycamore, we have 800 spaces.
And then
we have over half the need of the 1,500 you mentioned. Over half are there.
That's correct.
Okay, and then so the end of the line will want to do another hefty amount. So I guess the question I'd have is since we're going to do this study, is what's the need going to be for the one in the middle? Because we're in the process of having to acquire land for Mesa Drive, and I'm just wondering if we need as much space for the one in the center as opposed to the end of line one. So something to look at.
Mayor Smith, Councilmember Summers, or Vice Mayor Summers, excuse me.
Hey, you.
We have been looking at that very closely. We recognize that as we move the end of line further east, the demand goes with it. Even the park and ride at Sycamore today, we expect that some of that demand will move further east. In fact, we did an analysis a couple of years ago that recognized that a lot of those people that are using that park and ride today live east of Mesa Drive. So we expect that there's going to be some shift from Sycamore over to Mesa Drive, and once we open up the lot at Gilbert Road, there'll be a further shift. But we still expect that each of these sites will have some demand. In fact, when we do a project like this, we like to have park and ride spaced about 2 or 3 miles apart to provide good access. So we still expect demand at the two locations at Sycamore as well as at Mesa Drive, but we do expect that demand will reduce. And in fact, one of the things that we're doing as part of this expansion to Gilbert Road, as part of the environmental analysis, is to address that park and ride need at Mesa Drive. But we expect that need is, we haven't finished the analysis, but we're expecting that somewhere around 300 spaces is about what we think is going to still be needed at Mesa Drive.
Yeah,
we propose now is about 500 spaces. So, you know, we think there may be some reduction in space need there, but
Mesa Drive.
But there will still be need.
Reduction at the one in West Mesa as well? Well, it's all West Mesa.
Yeah, the one at Sycamore, we'd likely see a reduction in need for spaces there as well.
And potentially open that current surface parking up to some kind of development.
Exactly.
Maybe vertically integrated, which is what we see along the light rail line in Tempe.
Correct.
Parking that's integrated right. Within a development.
Ideally, over time, we would like to see those park and ride spaces be more efficiently utilized for development space and minimize the amount of parking over time.
Okay. I look forward to that report. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
The end of line park and ride study that we're doing, we're looking at two options. An area on the northwest corner of Gilbert and Main Street, and then an area on the southwest corner. We're looking at a variety of factors: traffic safety, access, vehicle circulation, costs, land uses, and as well as transit-oriented development opportunities. So this will, you know, we will come back next month with the.
When you look at these options, do you look at an either or an and?
This one will be an either. Either or, although it could be
it says you have one option or the other option. Isn't one of the options to use property on both sides of the street?
That certainly could be a part of it.
Mayor, maybe I'd like to address that if I could. We'd like to have one site. I mean, for the user, they don't, you know, if you don't find space on one side of the street, it's inconvenient and kind of a hassle to have to go over to the other side of the street. So ideally, having everything into one site is better. It's also better for us to provide security. We don't have to be looking at two different sites. We can be looking at one site. So ideally, from our perspective, we'd like it all packaged into one location.
I can understand that. I also look at a lot of buildings that would have to be removed, and I look at a lot of open space on both sides and wondering how you could work those. But I understand your operational issues. Yeah, Councilman Higgins.
Have we looked at going just a little further east by the canal where there's lots of more vacant? That's not proper grammar, but...
Well, part of...
Yeah, if we go just east of Gilbert, then you have all that.
Mayor and Councilmember, I think what ultimately has to happen, too, is when we get to this point... There's going to be a fairly robust discussion about where do we go from here.
Mm-hmm.
Do we go south on Gilbert? Do we go east on Main? And so that's part of that discussion, too. I think there's some talk about how we could situate this end-of-line station so that we would have the option either way down the future.
which would indicate you'd move further to the west, because if you're going to go south, you got to make that turn.
Exactly. Right. So and if you can stay, and you, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I get that. Councilman Fenter?
Just a quick question. Your thought process, if you were to choose, I presume you're trying to capture everything from the Southeast Valley, Gilbert, other areas. So if you're coming north along Gilbert or west along Main, by choosing the south parking lot, isn't there a challenge of trying to get in there and get parked from all that traffic coming in the morning, or is that part of your thought process?
That's all part of our study.
Okay.
So that's the vehicle.
That's one of the negatives.
That's the big one that stands out to me when you're talking.
Yeah, about left turns and right turns in and out of the park and ride lot. Oh, yes.
Thanks.
Moving on, stakeholder and public outreach. We've been very busy lately. We've actually held two neighborhood group meetings, 8 stakeholder meetings, 12 business owner meetings, 16 business owner meetings. Over the last 2 months, we've also held 2 public meetings, and we've actually had informational tables outside at Food City on 3 separate weekends. There will be many more to come. In general, the public and the stakeholders have been very supportive of the project and are eagerly awaiting it. Moving on, next steps. As Ms. Sorrell mentioned, we will be back here on the 6th to receive direction on the traffic configuration as well as the park ride location. And then in the spring, we will circulate our federal environmental assessment for a 30-day public comment. So with that, that concludes the presentation. I'd be more than happy to take any questions.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
No. Councilman Richards?
Yeah,
sure.
That sounds right. Okay. That sounds right.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation discussed by direction on the Fiesta Police Substation Solar Project. Mr. Boucher.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Today I'm here to give you an update on a project we've been working on and give you an update in regards to solar plans for the city of Mesa. What we're going to talk about today is the process that we've gone to get to the point that we are right now with solar services at the city of Mesa. Talk about a new delivery model that's known as a solar services agreement. And then specifically the Fiesta PD substation. We have a project that we hope to bring forward to you in the next couple of weeks. The SRP incentive program and some of the next steps, future plans that we have laid out for solar. First, the City of Mesa, what we did is we took a pre-qualified list from the City of Chandler. There were 12 pre-qualified vendors for providing solar services, and they had a cooperative agreement that the City of Mesa used. We went out and did an RFP to those 12 pre-qualified vendors for solar power services. From that, we awarded a contract to 2 solar providers, Solar City and Kitchell. It's a 3-year term with a possible 2-year renewal. Now, this contract doesn't actually commit the city to any expenditures. What it does is it allows staff to negotiate specific sites and pricing, so the technical and pricing specifications with different solar projects within the city. The model that I was telling you earlier is what's called a solar services agreement. Many of you are familiar, we have a couple of solar projects currently at the City of Mesa where the city owns the solar arrays. This is a different model where the solar vendor actually installs, operates, and maintains the solar system, and the city pays for the power that is generated from the system. So you'd have a separate solar services agreement for each site that lays out the size, the price per kilowatt hour, has some production guarantees associated with it, and then Mesa purchases that at a predetermined rate that's agreed upon. The term for those types of contracts is typically 20 years. There's usually some sort of purchase option throughout that 20-year period and ability to possibly extend those contracts. We are looking specifically right now, and we're negotiating with Solar City on an SSA for the Fiesta PD station. Where we're at right now, they've proposed a 262-kilowatt system, and the city would pay 5 cents per kilowatt hour for 20 years with no escalator. And that no escalator is a key, because typically in these types of agreements, they may have an escalator, whether it's 2, 3, 4%, that the price goes up each year throughout that 20-year term. Currently, what we're estimating, again, because the Fiesta PD station is not hasn't been built yet, so it's not operational, so there's estimates that we're using on some of these numbers for the station. We estimate that the price per kilowatt hour that we'd be paying from SRP is just over 8 cents per kilowatt hour, so we'd have savings from year one with this project. We estimate about 420,000 kilowatt hours produced annually, which is about 60% of the estimated energy use for the building. And that's a key. You don't want to go too high with that number where you're producing more energy than is actually used by the building, because then you're having to sell it back to SRP at a different rate than what you'd be getting for that retail rate. So you want to keep that down so that you make sure you're using all of the energy at the building. So the reason why we could get to that 5 cents per kilowatt hour, it's a very good price with that no escalator, is because the city of Mesa is actually going to own the parking structures and the conduit associated with this installation. Now, this was part of the original design of the police station, was for it to have covered parking. In essence, what we are doing, instead of putting a decking on top of those parking structures as it was originally designed, we're going to put solar panels on top of those. So we will own the steel and the conduit that's in the ground, and Solar City will have the solar panels that are up there on top of the structures. So the savings that we're estimating is about $400,000 over that 20-year period. And I will tell you, this is with an estimated 2% escalator on the price of power from SRP over the next 20 years. We're kind of anticipating that the price of power is not going to get cheaper. It's not even going to stay the same price. I can tell you over the last 10 years, it's averaged about 3.75% increase. So we feel this is a conservative estimate. But again, even if it stayed the same at that 8 cents a kilowatt hour, we have savings from year one with this project. There are purchase options at year 6, 10, and 20 if the city chooses to do that. And Solar City is required to remove the system at year 20 at the end of the contract term. So the city would have an option to continue the contract for another 5 years. If they're still working and they're producing and we're still saving money, we may take that option. But when the contract ends at year 20, Solar City would be required to then remove those solar panels.
Vice Mayor?
Scott, the technology for solar panels is improving dramatically, the efficiency mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. particular with the research coming out. What are the options in here, say at 6, 10, or 20 years, that Solar City would come in and replace those panels with more efficient panels, and perhaps we could generate even more electricity and better savings?
We would have options with Solar City if we wanted to do that. We'd have to open the contract back up. One of the things is with the panels, we don't want to produce more than what the building is using.
Correct.
So we'd have to continue to look at that balance between what is the building usage.
Well, we could get an 80%, you know, or 90 is keeping it below that 100% level, or there's the possibility that if you wanted to keep it 60 to 80%, maybe you shrink the footprint and the number of cells that are required to do that. It's just, it seems like, I guess the question is, how flexible is it to utilize some of these technologies that may be even more efficient?
Right. The other portion that we'd have to take into consideration is that SRP is providing an incentive for this project also, which is another 20-year contract where they're providing 4 cents per kilowatt hour. I'll get into the details of the SRP program, but we'd have to make sure with SRP also that they've they'd accept those changes. So it's possible. It's just we'd have to work with a couple different agencies. The other portion with SRP is that right now they have net metering, where you've got the ability to basically spin the meter backwards during the night or during the day. So you're looking at the total energy usage of the building as opposed to just what's at one time.
Well, isn't this all really
sort of academic, because we signed the contract for 20 years. The Solar City wants to come in and replace the panels. Based on the contract, they can reopen it, but you know, we got a 20-year contract.
Correct.
So whether it stays the same or whether they come in with more things, I mean, I don't know why. Isn't that sort of up to them and SRP?
And us also, because we're a part of
it. Well,
that
I know we're part of it, but we're signing up for a program, so.
Yes, we are.
Okay, so we don't really care as long as the original contract is.
We signed up for the rate.
Hit. The rate and all that.
Right. Right.
Okay.
So,
Councilman Higgins.
Yeah, you didn't say, why are you concerned with producing too much? Because it is net metering, right? So it will go.
Well, because if you produce more than you actually use, what you could do is you end up selling it back to SRP mm-hmm. for a wholesale rate. They call it the Palo Verde Index. So then you get down into the 2 or 3 cent range that SRP will pay you for that energy produced. Meanwhile, we're paying Solar City 5 cents. So it kind of flips that to the other side. We're paying 5 cents for energy that SRP then pays us 2 or 3 cents for, as opposed to paying 5 cents for energy.
So we don't pay for what we use, we pay for what's generated.
Right.
Wait, correct.
We pay for all of the energy that is generated from the solar system.
Okay. But if we're only at 60%,
then
we're
not
even close.
That's why you bring it down to a level that is that okay. you.
So this isn't like a normal deal that like homeowners get, because it sounds totally different. Because this isn't. I thought there were like different laws coming out that wouldn't allow that. You produce energy, they have to buy it back at the same rate they're selling it to.
I'm going to ask Jason.
And it doesn't matter, but it just seems a little different that you're paying for the energy you produce. It's kind of odd.
Well, homeowners can't produce 260.
No.
On their
well, it depends
generally.
On how big their field is,
it's
right?
Like one.
The mayor
one
can.
Kilowatt.
Well, homeowners.
I can do 10.
Well, let me ask you this. When a homeowner, just so we understand, we're sort of in a closed system type of thing here. Are we putting this into the grid? We're putting it into the grid, but it's assumed that, well, I'm getting people shaking heads both ways. Are we putting this in the grid and it's just credited to us, or are we actually, is this on-site kind of a smart meter closed grid type of a situation, and does it make a difference?
Hello, Mr. Mayor and Council. My name is Jason Dudley. I administer the commercial solar incentive program for the Salt River Project. There's a few questions that were asked. The first one I'll clarify. Is the electricity going to the grid, quote unquote? Ideally, what you want is an interconnection method with this solar electric system that actually feeds your service entrance. So the electricity generated by the system, you will actually be using.
Okay.
It goes to feed your load. What the solar system doesn't cover, if there's still electricity you need to power your buildings, you would just get from the grid. So you would be buying power from two sources. One is the solar electric system, and what that doesn't cover, then you would obviously be purchasing from SRP.
Okay. So we are using in the building. It's a closed system that then has a regulator that fills in the deficit with grid power. Is what I'm hearing.
Correct. But if it does,
that, and I get nothing but blank looks out there.
Well,
if there's a direct input into our service entrance, that means we're taking the power off those out of those photovoltaic cells and using them in that building.
Yes.
Okay. So that, I mean, whether this is a technically correct, to me, that's a closed system because you're going into the building. Whatever that building is using over and above what comes from the photovoltaic cells, they pull off the grid.
That's correct, sir.
Okay. And there's some regulator or something in there that allows that to happen. Okay, now at night, obviously you're not going to have anything from the PVC, so it's going to pull everything, and then it just regulates, and whatever you're on a cloudy day or whatever, your PVs are differing in their efficiency and the amount of power, well, then the building will just pull in what it needs off the grid system. This is not like other systems where the photovoltaic system feeds into the grid, and then you have one connection from the grid into the building, and you just get credits for the amount you put into the grid.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, in most homeowners, I don't know how it works. If it's a residential, does it go into the grid or is it going into the house? I thought it went into the grid. It goes into the house?
Ask him.
It goes into the house, sir.
Okay. All right. So it's basically the same thing, but on a much smaller scale.
That's correct.
Okay.
And if you will, allow me to please just clarify the net metering question.
No, we don't like things clarified anymore. confusion reigns in
point
this.
Let's be more confusing.
Point of order.
SRP recently increased the net metering capacity as a service to our large commercial customers. The net metering capacity is now 300 kW. What's being proposed here is 262 kW. So let me just clarify that if you do generate any excess kilowatt hours for any particular billing cycle, just to keep it simple, if you needed 100 kilowatt hours to power your building, but the system generated 150 kilowatt hours for that billing cycle, you would get a 50 kilowatt hour credit off of your next bill. The difference is, if you're generating so much so that at the end of SRP's fiscal year, which ends April 30th, you still have an excess kWh amount, then we will buy it back at the wholesale rate of credit, which, as Mr.
Boucher
explained, is based off the Palo Verde Index, about 2 or 3 cents currently.
Okay. So you bank in these, basically, and then the end of the year, you look and see where you end up.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And only at that time do you figure out whether there's a sale or not.
Right, and so it's ideal that you don't want to be producing so much so that at the end of the fiscal year, we have to SRP has to purchase the power back, because really that means that you paid for a system
twice,
for a bigger system than what you needed.
Yeah. Yes. And what we're saying is, at 60%, we're hopefully not close to that situation. We have plenty of cushion.
Correct.
Okay.
And when you end up with that, like say 50 kilowatts more, is it banked as a kilowatt or as a cost?
From
your example,
it's a kilowatt hour.
Okay. So
credit.
Then,
so a kilowatt hour, basically you would be saving 8.2 cents, if the information is correct, that you're paying for electricity. It's a full retail credit, which is
it's a kilowatt, and if you need it, you don't get charged for it because you already put it into the grid. But at the end of the day, at the end of the year, if you have way more, then it goes into
then
that
we purchase
other thing.
It back at the wholesale rate of electricity.
Right. Okay. Very cool. Thanks.
Okay. All right.
Just to give you an idea of what the system would look like, here's a layout from the design to the PD substation and the covered parking, the three covered parking areas. And this is an example from Solar City of a covered parking structure, and this is what the final product would look like. You can see it's nicely integrated into the parking structure.
Scott, this is where I asked that question about the opportunity to improve the efficiency of panels, because with three covered parking, it eats up space. And I don't know that we ever intend to do anything else with this piece of property, but if PD decides they need to add a structure in here for maintenance, then we'd have to find that location, and we have the potential to reuse this. Again, I don't know that we'd ever do that, but having that option may open up some land and still be able to produce more power. That's just why I asked.
Okay. Here's a look at the SRP program. We're hoping to bring the contract back to you for the November 19th council meeting. As you can see, SRP has 9 megawatts of power set aside for their large commercial program. They're currently at about 8 megawatts that they have committed to other projects, so we need to move quickly to make sure we get in with this incentive price of 4 cents a kilowatt hour. So we're hoping to have that contract back to you not this Monday's council meeting, but the following one. And then just for your information, so now that we have Solar City and Kitchell under contract and we're doing these negotiations, I just showed you what a deal would look like with the Fiesta PD. We are looking at other facilities. Some of the facilities that we're currently in conversations with both of those solar providers are the Southeast Water Reclamation Plant, possibly the Red Mountain Multigen Center, and also the East Mesa Service Center. In addition, we're looking at other properties that may be available, but these are the ones currently that we're having discussions with them about. And we have to have those same discussions in regards to future use of land. That really becomes one of the bigger issues, is what is the future use of these lands, because you do sign a long-term contract for having these solar panels at the sites.
Public safety building.
So with that, I'll take any questions.
Okay, any questions? Okay, Vice Mayor.
Public safety building. It's a big piece of land.
We have looked at that one also. It wasn't one of the ones that rose. It wasn't one of the ones that rose to the top right in the beginning when we were looking at these projects. Some of these other sites seem to be better. What you have to do is look at the current rate that you're paying with SRP, look at the space that's available, the interconnections, how many meters you have, what the building loads are. So as we've been looking, and that's why we have these contracts, so that we can really get into those technical discussions with the solar providers. So SRP's program changes every year. So it's you have to make sure that you're prepared for the new program when SRP comes out, but that is one that we have done a site walk on, and we will continue to look at into the future.
And for people who are watching, looking at the solar service agreement, what and we're talking about a commercial piece, and maybe this is for the gentleman from SRP, what opportunities are there for our residential customers to do projects like this? You want to do this, don't you, Dave?
If I understand the question, you're asking what opportunities are there for residential customers to enter into solar service agreements?
Or whatever opportunities they have to do something like this if they were interested.
If a residential customer wishes to purchase or lease a solar electric system, they are more than welcome to in our service territory. We do have a program for residential customers where we actually provide incentives for them to do so. And it's been a program that's been very successful since 2004, if I'm not mistaken.
You have a website for that?
Yes, sir. srpnet.com/solar.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. Councilor Richlands.
Where does Solar City purchase their solar panels? What manufacturer do they use?
This is the manufacturer for these panels is going to be Yingli.
They're Chinese solar panels?
Yes, they are.
Thanks.
But as we found out, even Chinese solar panels are about 60% U.S. components. Do you know that? Yeah. Most of the silicone and the... we found it's with this tariff that the Federal Trade that was done by the... I never can remember the German company that filed that. That's one instance where almost all the silicone is manufactured, I think, out of a plant in Indiana or Ohio. And most of the other PV stuff is made by Texas Instruments. And so we actually, this is, they get shipped to China and assembled in China. This is one of those strange things that, the U.S. actually manufactures the majority of the components in photovoltaic things. Then I never knew that until that came out. Councilman, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item is appointments to boards and committees. What you have before you is really the reconfiguration. When we eliminated the two housing-related committees and we put them together in one, this is the reconfiguration of that committee into the single Housing and Community Development Advisory Board. So I entertain a motion to from Councilman Glover, second from Vice Mayor Summers. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Any reports? Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. My notes here. We have a council meeting on, this weekend is GAIN night. GAIN night. And I think hopefully PD has contacted every one of you and set up. We had a great kickoff for GAIN, and we expect a big turnout for this Saturday night. So we're excited for the neighborhoods, and then we will see you on Monday for I don't think we have any items before the council meeting, so we'll just be reviewing the agenda again on Monday. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Crocker, any requests to speak?
No. Request, Mayor.
All right, I have a motion by the Vice Mayor to enter an executive session. Second, Councilmember Glover. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We are moving to executive session. Thank you.